Now we turn to an idea that seems simple enough, curing a disease by replacing the faulty genes that cause it. Now it works this way. Take a person with an illness caused by one or more faulty genes, take the corrected versions of the genes and insert them back into the person and hope that the good genes correct the problem. That's the idea behind gene therapy, but to date, most attempts to cure genetic diseases this way have not succeeded. This week comes news of the first effort by researchers in New York and New Zealand to treat Parkinson's disease by inserting genes directly into the brains of people with severe cases of the disease. And the first surgery was done this week. The neurosurgeon who did the operation is here to talk about it. He has been criticized by some observers who say this clinical trial is premature because the procedure, they say, has not been tested enough on laboratory animals to ensure its safety and efficacy. We'll talk about that, too. So if you'd like to join our discussion, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. As always, you can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. Well, is it safe enough? Is it efficacious? Let's talk about it. Let me introduce my guest. Michael Kaplit is assistant professor of neurological surgery at the Weill Cornell Medical College and director of the Center for Stereotactic and Functional Neurosurgery at New York Presbyterian Hospital, Weill Cornell Medical Center here in New York. He's here in our New York studios. Welcome, Dr. Kaplit.
Thanks for having me.
Theodore Friedman is the chair of the Recombinant DNA Advisory Committee for the National Institutes of Health. He's also a professor of pediatrics, the Muriel Jeanette Whitehill Chair in Biomedical Ethics, and the director of the program in the Human Gene Therapy at the University of California, San Diego, and he joins us today from the campus there. Welcome to the program, Dr. Friedman.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Thank you. Dr. Kaplit, tell us, on Monday you made the first attempt to treat Parkinson's with gene therapy. Can you give us a thumbnail of how you did that?
Sure. What we did was we performed an operation that in most respects was identical to a standard operation that we do right now routinely for patients with Parkinson's disease who are no longer responding well to medical therapy or who have side effects from medical therapy. And what that entails is making a hole in the skull the size of a quarter and finding a spot deep in the brain that we can initially visualize on MRI or other advanced imaging technologies. And then we probe that area of the brain with fine electrodes while the patient is awake so that we can ensure that we can accurately identify this very tiny structure and operate in the right space. Now, normally at that point, what we would have done is put in a stimulating electrode that we would attach through a wire to a battery in the chest, and this is called deep brain stimulation, and this is current standard surgery for Parkinson's disease.
Mm-hmm. And gene therapy, then, is where you took the genes, were these his own genes,
right,
or what
happened? So at this point, instead of putting in the electrode, right, we injected into the same spot these viruses that contain a copy of a human gene that will essentially change the function of the cells in this area of the brain and try to make them function in a way that would be more like the normal brain.
And how do you get the genes to go where you want them to go?
Well, first by where we inject them using this technique so that we're putting this very fine tube or catheter the size of roughly a human hair into this area. And then we also ensure that the gene can actually efficiently get into these cells using these modified viruses, since viruses have evolved over millions of years to be very efficient nature's gene delivery vehicles, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Friedman, you're chair of the Recombinant DNA Advisory Committee. What is wrong? Is anything wrong with the technique that we're talking about here?
Well, first of all, let me make a little caveat that in this morning's session, I won't be speaking as official chair of the RAC. You'll hear my opinions, independent scientific opinions, but these opinions are not necessarily the ones that the RAC and the NIH would present. So just with that caveat. I think there's a lot of promise, of course, in gene therapy, and many of those the studies being done in gene therapy involve viruses. They're disabled. They're engineered so that they don't produce their own disease any longer or produce any disease whatsoever. And they're just used as kind of Trojan horses to sneak genes into cells. And the field has grown up around the concept that that would be a very useful thing to do. Mm-hmm. As you know, the field has had many ups and downs. It's been a very, very difficult field to try to deliver real therapy. And I think your program did a session some months ago on the French study involving a different disease with a different kind of vector. But many people think that that was a real success, that these children have been therapeutically helped by the manipulation. And so I think we all would like to think that introducing genes for the right disease into the right cell at the right time in an appropriately regulated way can be therapeutic.
We're talking about gene therapy this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Of course, the FDA approved the trial last year. It is a phase one trial, Dr. Caplet, correct?
Correct.
And that phase one means you're just testing out?
By definition, phase one means that it's a safety study, which means the purpose of the study is to determine whether this is safe in human beings as we try to move forward to develop it and determine whether it can ultimately be effective.
But your critics have said that this was not tested out well enough in laboratory animals before. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think that we have tried over the years to do as much as possible to first and foremost worry about safety before we would consider going to human patients. We've been, my colleagues and I, particularly my colleague Matt Turing, who has helped develop this along with me, have been working in this field for 15 years, and we've been specifically working on this particular vehicle, the so-called adeno-associated virus, for over 10 years. We have experience not only in our own labs, but there have been many other labs working with this vehicle over that period in literally thousands of rats and numerous monkey studies, both before this trial as well as in support of this trial. We had both a monkey safety study that was presented to the RAC committee as well as to the FDA, where we followed these monkeys for over a year. Our rat efficacy data was published in Science magazine in this past fall in October. And those animals were followed for an extensive period of time. In none of the rats and in none of these monkeys that we had followed for over a year did we see any evidence of damage to the brain, any behavioral problems, any evidence of toxicity. The only thing that we had ever seen was a transient fever in a couple of animals in the first 24 hours that disappeared. So after all of that, which was all presented publicly at the RAC meeting, which, by the way, is webcast even, so that anyone in the public can see these meetings, and then was that was presented 2.5 years ago, and then was subsequently presented to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, who analyzed this for over a year, then was reviewed by our institutional review board, our peer review board at Weill Cornell, as well as at North Shore Hospital, where this is being carried out, as well as the data that I said that was published in Science magazine. We felt that after all of this time, that we were comfortable that safety was the first and foremost thing that we had demonstrated, even though there is always the caveat that this has not been tried in human beings, and that is the reason why this is a safety study.
Mm. Dr. Friedman, do you find any problem with the studies that were done prior to these?
I think when the RAC reviewed the proposals, as Dr. Caplet said, we went back to him and to Dr. Turing with a whole series of recommendations for what we thought might be improvements in the study involving technical things, scientific questions. Where does the virus go? What cells does it infect? And what's the long-term consequence of that in an appropriate animal model? And that means, of course, rats and mice, but then in a monkey model, which is engineered to resemble real Parkinson's disease. And I think many of the criticisms that you've heard in the last few days really center around the fact that the general community, the general Parkinson's community and scientific community, haven't seen these results in published form and therefore can't really comment on how faithful the model is in the monkey studies. And of course, the time required for follow-up has been relatively short. So the Parkinson's community, I think, still has some concerns that the long-term consequences of this really quite imaginative and unique study are still not known, and therefore there's still a safety question in the minds of people who are following the study.
All right, we'll get your rebuttal. We have to take a short break, come back, and talk more with Michael Caplet and Theodore Friedman about this gene therapy study on the first one of its kind on Parkinson's on humans. Stay with us. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about gene therapy for Parkinson's disease. My guests are Theodore Friedman, chair of the Recombinant DNA Advisory Committee for the National Institutes of Health and professor of pediatrics at the University of California, San Diego. Michael Kaplet, assistant professor of neurological surgery at the Weill Cornell Medical College right here in New York. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let's turn it over to Dr. Kaplet. Following up on the Dr. Friedman was saying, possibly the monkey studies haven't been published yet.
Well, what I wanted to do is actually make a follow-on, not so much as a rebuttal, because I actually agree with much of what Dr. Friedman just said. What I wanted to add was, first of all, aside from the fact that much of the monkey efficacy data has not yet been published, and I understand that, but what we had presented to the RAC, of course, was the rat efficacy data that has been published in Science, as I mentioned, as well as extensive primate safety data for over a year, and that was presented in a public forum and then reviewed by the FDA. But more importantly than that, I think people should be aware a bit about the concept behind this, because there are additional safety measures that we have tried to address beyond simply doing what we believe is extensive animal safety testing in advance. In particular, the operation that we are doing is designed specifically to try to take advantage of what we know works best today in human beings, not in animals. So as I mentioned, for patients with Parkinson's disease, one of their problems is that there is an area deep in the brain that is abnormally active. And what we try to do to relieve those symptoms is quiet that area down, either by destroying the area, so-called subthalamotomy, for example, or put in these deep brain stimulating electrodes to electrically silence the area. So we know silencing this area can have benefit to patients, human beings with Parkinson's disease today. Now, when you look at the circuit and the chemistry of that area, one of the reasons why that area becomes hyperactive is because there is a chemical being released from different parts of the brain into that area, and it's a chemical called GABA. And that usually acts as the brain's brake. It silences brain areas. And so what we've decided to do is go into this area and put the gene in that will allow it to make its own GABA and quiet itself down more naturally and try to reestablish the normal chemical balance that should ordinarily be in this area of the brain. Now, as I just mentioned, one of the operations that is being done in many places around the world right now is to destroy this area of the brain. So if there was something to occur, for example, that we have not yet seen in any of our animal studies, where there would be a problem from making too much of this chemical GABA, one of the potential options that we could have would be to go back into that same place and either put in one of these electrodes to try to quiet that down, or in the extreme example, destroy this area, and that is a treatment that is being done right now in human patients for Parkinson's, and that would destroy the source of this GABA production. So we have even tried to build into this protocol measures that would give us options, even for those things that could happen that we have not seen in any of our animals.
Well, why not wait till after you've published the monkey data to make people, you know, less wary that you're going ahead with this? Even this groundbreaking, I think everybody will agree, it's a groundbreaking surgery, to wait for that to come out?
Well, first of all, like we said, we waited for the Science paper to come out with our rodent data. It is, I think it's a bit unclear at best whether primate efficacy data, and our data will be coming out and be published, but whether primate efficacy data actually has any real bearing on success or failure in human patients. For example, there were some very nice positive results from primates with fetal cell transplantation, and of course that's been a difficult human study. Deep brain stimulation that I just mentioned, which we are using in human beings right now, has not been tested in primates. So I don't know whether there is a real clear evidence that success or failure in primates really defines success or failure in human beings, but we felt comfortable that we had extensive efficacy data in our rodents. We have the results that will be coming out on our primates, and we have extensive safety testing where we felt comfortable that this would be a reasonable thing to do.
Dr. Friedman, anything wrong with this logic?
Well, I would like to push it a little further, and in conversations with my neurological and neuroscience friends, I hear the argument very often that, of course, the rodent is not wired in the same way as primate brain, and that what you see in terms of both safety and the overall effect on the global function of the brain in the rat cannot be extrapolated quite very easily to the primate and to the human. The brain functions in very interactive and very sort of highly orchestrated and choreographed and finely tuned pathways. And if one were to disrupt any one of those pathways, then the chances of wreaking havoc in the brain are fairly good and not necessarily detectable in rodent studies. I mean, we've learned that from as Dr. Caplet said, from the failure, more or less failure, of the fetal implant studies, and the great promise now of the stem cell approach, although we're likely to run into unforeseen difficulties with that as well. I think Dr. Caplet and Dehring are really to be commended for this different approach to Parkinson's. They've chosen a unique approach, but all the more reason to prove it to the hilt. And the natural stopping point before you go to the clinic is to pick absolutely the most relevant animal model that exists. And in that case, in this case, the most relevant model is really a damaged monkey brain that really mimics the Parkinson's phenotype, the Parkinson's situation. And as far as we can tell, at least from the literature and in presentations, the demonstration of real efficacy and safety long-term in this animal model, in the Parkinsonian monkey, is what's so glaringly absent in the discussions. And so we would all like to see that. We're all reminded, of course, about making too much, raising too many expectations with preliminary studies. The field of gene therapy has suffered from that in the past, and we certainly want to be sure that when we describe a potential new approach to therapy, that we're really going to be able to deliver. And that's what we would all hope for.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would simply add that the whole reason that we took this very approach, as opposed to many of the approaches that we and others have worked on over the years that we did not feel was ready for the clinic and that we did not pursue, is precisely because we felt that this was a more conservative and more rational approach to trying to safely bring gene therapy to the brain to provide some efficacy for our patients without in any way attempting to even promise a cure for the disease with this approach. Because I personally think that when we attempt to overreach and try to promise cures or develop things and only put things in that represent cures, that sometimes we can either, on the one hand, inappropriately delay innovative therapies, or on the other hand, get into trouble with toxicity. I would add that there is a published study in human patients where this chemical GABA was actually directly injected into this very area of the human brain in awake patients during standard Parkinson's disease surgery, and that those patients, the area did quiet down, and those patients' symptoms transiently improved while that chemical was there. And we also used that as part of our rationale. So based on our experience in human beings with quieting this area down both electrically as well as injecting this very chemical that the gene would allow us to make, as well as based on the ability to have these backup measures to potentially protect a patient if there were potential mm-hmm. problems, that was the whole genesis of this idea.
And the patient was fully informed about the risks.
Oh, without question. Absolutely. The patient had to not only sign a 30-page informed consent, but we spent numerous hours on several sessions, both at my own institution as well as the neurologists, David Eidelberg and Andrew Fagan at North Shore Hospital and in Long Island, who are the ones who, by the way, are both recruiting patients as well as determining the outcome. They spent many hours as well with him explaining all of this.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's see if we can get a phone call or two before we have to say goodbye for the hour. Barry, somewhere in a car in Minneapolis. Hi, Barry.
Good afternoon. One of the appeals, I believe, from the patient's perspective of deep brain stimulation is the fact that it's relatively reversible. If you don't have the therapeutic effect you want, you can remove or move the electrode, whereas ablation and gene therapy don't seem to offer that kind of an alternative. Can you maybe address some of the patient concerns and things that will make this an acceptable therapy should it come to that point? I'll take it off the radio.
Sure. Can you reverse if you were mentioning you could go back in?
Well, as I told you, we believe our science paper, for example, demonstrated that we actually can regulate the amount of this GABA that's made if we put an electrode into this area, the subthalamic nucleus, after the gene therapy. So that represents a possibility to try to ultimately regulate this. I agree that right now, the way this gene therapy is being done, it's intended to not be regulatable. It's intended to simply be on all the time. And the future, hopefully, we will all be developing gene therapeutics that could be regulated by a pill or so. Mm-hmm. But I will say that deep brain stimulation, which I do regularly, and it's what I specialize in, is something that has its own risk and benefit ratio. For example, many patients do not like the idea of leaving hardware in their body with electrodes in their brain, wires under their skin, and batteries in their chest that have to be changed every few years that can become infected at times and need to be taken out, that can cause pain, etc. So I think we always have to balance, and a lot of patients like the idea of having a single operation and then not having hardware if it's possible.
We're talking about gene therapy this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Dr. Friedman.
Yes, I wanted to support what Dr. Kaplan just said about the need for being able to reverse what you do. I think the question now in such a complicated disease, with such a complicated approach, would be to demonstrate that in an appropriate animal model in the Parkinsonian monkey. I think that all of us would be very much more comforted by long-term studies in the monkey showing real change in the behavior of the monkey, reduction of the excitatory function of this nucleus, and that it doesn't lead to sort of imbalance on all the other neurotransmitter pathways and very unexpected and really harmful effects that one can imagine. So
haven't there been other gene therapy patients where they've had, for example, patients for immune disorders, developing leukemia, things like that?
Yes. Well, the program that you did some months ago in the French and the British study involving the immune disease, the bubble boy syndrome, mm-hmm. It looks as if at least 10 or 11 of those children really have got a major therapeutic benefit. Two of them did develop leukemia. They've responded to it. But that proves the point, in fact, that no matter how pretty the theory of the approach, and the French study was really quite a beautifully theorized study. No matter how beautiful the concept, you have to be prepared for unexpected adverse consequences and prethink them and rule them out as best you can.
Dr. Kaplan, will we know if this was successful? How will we know?
Well, there are several measures that we've built into this study. First of all, as I said, success or failure in this particular study is safety. That's the purpose of the study. So certainly we will know if his symptoms don't significantly worsen any more so than one would expect for natural progression of the disease, and if he does not develop any new neurologic or other problems, then we'll certainly know, and with other patients as well, that the safety angle will have been met. We also have built in, of course, extensive clinical measures to see whether his symptoms change at all over time, for good or bad, whether his medications change over time, extensive neuropsychological testing frequently, and then especially, which we think is one of the more attractive features of this trial, is we've built in PET scanning, which is a non-invasive way to look at the functioning of the different areas of the brain that are affected by our potential gene therapy. And this is something that we also built into this monkey study that is currently being written up. And so we have tried actually to test this in the preclinical setting as well. But this way, we have already, for example, scanned this particular patient in advance of surgery, and he'll get these regular scans over time.
All right. I'd like to thank my guests. We've run out of time. Dr. Michael Kaplan, who is assistant professor of neurological surgery at the Weill Cornell Medical College and director of the Center for Stereotactic and Functional Neurosurgery at New York Presbyterian Hospital, Weill Cornell Medical College here in New York. Theodore Friedman, chair of the Recombinant DNA Advisory Committee for the National Institutes of Health. He's also a professor of pediatrics at the Muriel Jeanette Whithill Chair in Biomedical Ethics and director of the program in human gene therapy at the University of California, San Diego. Thank you both for joining us this hour. Our program today is produced by Annette Heist, Annalise Strachan, and senior producer Karen Vergoth. Charles Berquist is our director. If you missed any of the stuff we talked about today and want to send us some email and get more information, surf over to our webpage at sciencefriday.com. You can also check out Science Friday's Kids Connection, which is free material that we make for children and their teachers to use in classrooms. Also, you can download past editions of Science Friday and also listen to it on your Audible player. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.